This is Beyond the Black Stump, a new podcast for the risk resilience and continuity communities. This show will offer ideas about leadership and learning that can help remove some of the limitations we place on ourselves and our own thinking. Welcome to episode 2 of the show. My name is Ken Simpson and I'm the host of this show. This episode is particularly exciting because it's also the first one-on-one interview format for the show. When I developed the idea for this podcast, I knew who I needed to chat with in this first episode. My guest today is one of the emerging young voices in this industry. He's built his own social media audience around his blog based upon business continuity and his own experiences, a LinkedIn group he's established where people go to discuss a whole range of issues in the industry, and on his Twitter feed. All of his work is focused around business continuity. His articles have been published on Continuity Central. He's contributed an article to the BCI's 20 in Their 20s publication this year. And he's also compiled his own experiences and blog posts into an ebook that's available on Amazon. If all of that wasn't enough, my guest today was also the BCI's International Newcomer of the Year for 2014. So please join me as we attempt to go beyond the black stump with Mr. Luke Bird. So Luke, after all this time, great to actually chat to you. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Nice to finally put a voice to the name and the frequent emails.
That's right. It's been over 12 months now we've been communicating via email thereabouts.
And this is possibly longer.
Yeah, and it's the first time we've actually spoken.
Well, hopefully you can understand my dulcet Birmingham West Midlands tones from the UK.
I think we're putting a challenge to many of our international colleagues to understand both our accents, but that's the nature of audio and podcast, I guess.
Definitely.
So, Luke, the show is about learning and thinking and the journey. The concept of the black stump is a metaphor from early Australian history where surveyors would mark a black stump as the limit of the surveyed landscape, the known universe, if you like. And so I wanted to talk to you to start with a little bit about the journey that you've been on. I mean, you've got this great picture on your blog. It's about you, intersection, there's signposts pointing in different directions. Tell us a little about the paths you've followed and the kind of learnings that have led to your current situation.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. On my blog, it's a picture paints a thousand words. Probably for most people, I imagine, sort of 0 to 5 years into a profession, in any profession, I think you're caught up in somewhat of a whirlwind of different levels of exposure to different situations and incidents. And I think when I started my blog, I was certainly at that point. There was several different directions and thought processes going through my mind. Didn't really know where to turn. So there's a very confused photo of me on my blog there to demonstrate that. But really, yeah, for the last 5 years, I'm one of the new emerging generation of emergency management and business continuity purists. So I'm fresh out of the blocks from university, having done my disaster management and emergency planning degree, and shifted neatly into public sector environment for emergency management within local governments. And so my exposure there was predominantly working on the behalf of the community during major incidents, the usual floods, famine, fuel strikes, pandemic flu, industrial action, making sure that the local communities were looked after and cared for and evacuated safely during any major incident or event. So that was really my initial exposure for the first few years. But following on from that, I progressed into a private sector business continuity executive role with an international IT outsourcing provider. And they face off to many clients and provide services, of which business continuity is one of them. And that's really where I got my wider exposure to things like work area recovery sites, setting them up, understanding the challenges involved with applying the business to them. And then also we looked at we've had a complete rollout now, completed this month for the International Standard 22301, the new resilience standard. And we've rolled that out on behalf of a client, which is one of the largest investment banks in Europe. So it's been quite a journey in the last 5 years for me personally.
Yeah, no, it certainly sounds like it. And what led you, because as you said, you're one of this new generation that are coming through universities and tertiary education straight into the profession. What led you down this path in the first place?
That's a good question. I could probably give you two answers. I suppose the best response I could probably give to that is saying that from a young age anyway, I wanted to work in a role where I felt like I was becoming I was part of something, part of a real purpose, and so hence why I went into community resilience within local government because I wanted to feel like I was providing a contribution back to the wider society, I suppose, if that was my cheesy answer. But my professional answer is, looking back over the last 5 years, I think perhaps the reason I got involved was because I have a tendency to look at look for gaps in process, look for risks. I have a natural inclination to spot holes and things. And this sort of role complements that sort of mindset, I think.
Think you're definitely right.
I think that's how I've arrived at it, really.
Yeah. I think a lot of people would take the same view, that the business continuity guy, the risk guys, that they're the ones that are just looking at the whole process and trying to see the flaws that other people don't see.
That's right, yeah, definitely.
Okay, look, you mentioned in your introduction there that you've just done a big rollout of 22301 for a client. And on your blog, a lot of your writing has been around this process of gaining certification against standard. You also, in my view, contribute some element of thought leadership in this industry. Now, how do you see the idea of thought leadership in the context of standards and management systems thinking? I mean, what do you see as the scope for thought leadership in that context?
I think that the journey to which it's come at the moment, and I still think it's very much on a journey. I think that when I first looked, I realised I was taking the lead on rolling out a major ISO project. First and foremost, it's been done before with other standards to other areas, your environment, your quality, IT security, these sorts of things. This is not new science in terms of its methodology, but business continuity was evolving. And so the thought leadership, if I'm entirely honest, my impressions of it from a year or two ago when I started to research current thought leadership and debates and conversations, I felt like it was fairly limited. I felt like there was all I could find, really, if I'm being truly honest, was I could find half-baked lip service, which usually neatly linked into somebody providing some sort of BC-related product or consultancy. And that's the sweeping generalisation, I know. But I felt that it was all bit part. I couldn't really get a full and clear answer as to what I was letting myself in for. So, and that doesn't just relate to the ISO. I think with the thought leadership, it relates to across the board. I became increasingly frustrated for a short period of time because I didn't feel like I could find the answers I needed. And with the growing social media and web presence, I was quite surprised by that, particularly coming from an academic and research background as well. So I really think that it is growing now, and we're at a position where it's starting to mature and more people are contributing. We still a long way to go, though, in my view.
So, I would hope people understand that it's a journey. It we're never going to get to some nirvana for information yes, being out there. So where do you go today, now that you've been around a few years, where do you go to find leadership thinking in this space?
Right. Well, I think one of the key things for me in the chaos of the first few years of trying to find, get the most exposure I could, was trying to find the right links for mentors. There's a few regular contributors on social media. So first thing I did was I went onto things like LinkedIn and to Twitter and search your classic standards and business continuity and tried to find these big groups with big followings, tried to read some of the conversations about what was happening, and that was my initial step. And I did try to find some sorts of journals and contributions there, but that was actually more difficult. And then before that, I have a stream of books written by the likes of Hiles, who have these business continuity handbooks, which provide you with a good basis of foundations for what we do. So that was really my source of information at the very beginning, but as I say, it was fairly limited at the very beginning.
Okay.
Now the groups are great.
Absolutely. And you've actually created one of those with your blog and with some of your writing. You know, I think at one point you described your own work as just venting. You talked about the situations that young professionals found themselves in. So what, you know, this pay it backwards idea, what would you tell your 22-year-old self, or what would you say to those who are just starting out and facing similar issues and perhaps not speaking up and sharing at the moment?
I think in hindsight, one or two of the pieces of advice I was given that I perhaps took on but didn't really fully appreciate and accept at the time. One thing that's always stuck in my mind was somebody said, and I make reference to it in one of my blogs about cross-linking to my sailing and saying that you only ever really get better at sailing if you accept the fact that you're going to fall in a few times. And once you fall in, you actually become. It's a quicker learning process once you get wet. But the fear of getting wet in the first place is a boundary in itself, and the self-preservation kicks in, and you tend not to take the risk to gain greater exposure. And the way you respond to certain incidents and the way you approach your professional situations, you tend to limit yourself in your development. Well, I certainly did. And someone said to me 3 or 4 years ago, when I went to him a few years ago, he said to me, "You're not experienced enough." He says, go and get some more experience. And he says, don't be afraid to step on a few landmines. He said, everybody needs to learn some really big lessons. That's how we develop. And I think that would be going back to my 22-year-old self. I'd be saying, spend more time on trying to get it right than trying to be scared of getting it wrong.
Yeah, good advice. We do spend too much time, I think, sometimes being cautious and not being willing to take a risk.
Yeah, and people are scared in this industry, in my view. They, particularly the junior professionals, there are naturally, with business continuity and crisis management, there are some very strong characters in the business. And particularly in government side of things, in order to get the right airtime, it has to sound, for want of a better phrase, sexier. So there's a lot of loud voices, strong personalities. And for a wet behind the ears new graduate like myself coming through, it's very difficult to sort of filter out what's valuable, not valuable, and then having the guts to actually step in. It took me a good 3 years probably to go, I've actually got a point of view here. I was genuinely quite fearful of making a contribution, partially because of the characters I was working with and partially because I was scared of making a mistake or sounding silly.
Yeah, and that comes out in quite a bit of your writing at different times as well. But it's good to see you found the voice. Let me read you something, see if you recognise it. We'll talk about it a bit. The business continuity landscape is changing. There's a new and rapidly growing breed of professionals directly entering into the industry from universities and colleges. The very makeup of the profession is evolving as our membership moves away from those who were perhaps dropped into business continuity almost by accident. I assume you recognise the words.
Absolutely. That's a long-standing view of mine. It's scary. It's as scary for me as it is for the perhaps the elder statesman reading it as well.
Well, the interesting part, when I wrote, and for the people listening, Luke wrote that in his 20 in their 20s article, which will be linked in the show notes for people who can need to go and find. To me, that was a really profound thing. I hadn't necessarily grasped how many people were coming into this business through this path. But what do we need to do? I mean, you've been through this path. As an industry, what do we need to do to address this dramatic shift of people coming in through that path rather than coming through that school of hard knocks?
Right, well, I'm sure some of them would love to be to know that they've been described as hard knocks.
Well, that's the way we used to see it. You know, you go in, most people who came into this when I did, too long ago to even think about, it certainly wasn't a job that you would seek out. Normally it was the person who didn't step back fast enough. It was up there with fire wardens for the job that you tried to avoid. So if people are coming in direct from tertiary education and with a totally different mindset and expectation, what kind of training and education do we need to be putting in place to meet these people's needs?
I think that we do have to mature on so many on a number of different platforms, I think, to get where we want to be. I mean, you only have to compare us against other. If you look at the institutes that represent business continuity disasters and so on across the globe, they are evolving. They are becoming bigger, and their voice is becoming more known. But if you look at things like the insurance, the Chartered Institute of Insurance, or other wider institutes, we just need to improve a little. So, for instance, in terms of the training, I think what I would have benefited from was a solid program of maturity, rather than having two simple checkpoints of, did I pass an exam, a competency exam? Yes. All of a sudden, I made an associate member, or if I passed it high enough, and I've been working in a job for 3 years, and I can send enough PDF examples, all of a sudden I'm a full member. I don't think that's a true reflection. The PDP and evidence-based competency is something that we have a little bit more of a gap in when you compare it to other institutes around the world, in my view. I also feel there's perhaps a gap in peer review. There's in areas, if you're, for me, working where I am at the moment, there's people in my... It's not just the institute. I'm talking about the individuals as well. Junior professionals are scared to contribute. At last year's BCI conference, I went all out to try and engage with as many junior pros as possible, particularly those with an online presence. I met with them all individually, and they're all really great, willing people. And I also met other people who don't have an online presence but knew what we do, and they read it in their own time. And off the back of those conversations, virtually no follow-up has occurred. We need to understand why that is, and to encourage more people to contribute. To be honest, I know one of the answers to that already. If you go online and you come up with a new idea or a new thought relating to resilience in any way, you put it out onto one of the groups and come back in 2 weeks' time, you'll have a series of, as you say, hard knocks usually, will give you pages and pages of what feels like abuse. It's their opportunity to get on their soapbox and sort of shoot you down, if you will. I have this view. Well, you're wrong because of, and then there's several pages. I've only really experienced a few times where some people have come on and said, that's a good point, but really what you're missing there is X, Y, and Z, and more collaborative learning rather than get back in your box and have a voice in 10 years' time once you've got enough experience?
Yeah, it's sometimes, look, I don't take it to heart. I still get people telling me I have no idea what I'm talking about, probably because I tend to take a lot of contrary views to others. So the kind of things you're talking about there sounds to me like we've got a bit of work to do with the vocational training, the on-the-job training. Yeah. If you were an accountant, it would be called your professional year or your certification year, wouldn't it?
It's that we do need to align ourselves to similar practices and understand where it can be applicable to BC. Obviously, because we've got an interesting area of expertise which is still evolving itself in terms of in the concept alone. That it's going to be a moving target, but it's certainly more widely shared and collaborated in potential improvements on what it is and how we develop, not just from junior professional, right the way.
Do you see a role for, like, you've done a lot of work with new media, with social media, using it as a tool to promote your voice. Surely there's a role there for not just social media, but online courses, devices like podcasts and webinars and that kind of thing to address the learning needs that are emerging here?
Absolutely. I mean, half the reason and what you're doing now is a great example of taking it to the next level and getting us to that next level of maturity. I'm hoping that people will hear this. They'll put a voice to the name. They'll realise that Luke Bird is just your everyman that's worked his way into this profession as switched on as the next guy, and they can take from that they can take confidence that they can learn this as well. And these sorts of things, these social media, everybody's got 5 or 6 different social media platforms and everybody uses it. People, you'd be surprised, you know yourself, to be fair, Ken, you've had a wide online presence. It's amazing the people that reach out to you from around the world. And the reason why we were sat on this today is primarily because we both reached out to one another over a year ago. There is a real lack of that, and I think that this sort of thing, like your podcast, your BCM journal that's growing in involvement, I think those sorts of things are really important as we move forward. There's actually the name escapes me now, but there's actually a gentleman who provides a sort of web. From his website, he stands in front of his website and he explains certain parts of information that people can find for free. He doesn't charge anybody. And I approached him a year ago and I said, "Why do you do it? I mean, I know why I don't do it. Why I do it because I don't get paid for it. It's because I was venting to begin with, but then I wanted to help." And he said the exact same thing. He just wanted to provide advice and support for people that wanted to embed BC into their business. The gentleman's name's Alistair Lee, but he's a fabulous bloke.
There's a lot of people who do offer a massive amount of material just to be helpful. So the world's a fairly good place like that sometimes.
Yeah.
So let me dust out the crystal ball. Let's go look beyond the black stump, out into the area of discomfort. You wrote a post, The Avoidance and Illusion of Competence, where you said a comfort zone is like a warm blanket on a cold winter morning. People do not want to move. That's the same idea of the comfort zone, the metaphor of the black stump. That not wanting to move, is that a big risk for our professional development? And what do you suggest we need to do about that comfort zone?
I've always felt this, well, from the last 5 years, I've always felt if you can cover off a couple of different areas then and get yourself to a new level of maturity, you encourage new thinking anyway. If you empower departments and organisations to sort of self-sustain their own resilience, that's probably why it hasn't happened, because if I did it right, then I'd be put out of a job, wouldn't I? So, but I do think you've got a first of all, one of the biggest obstacles is you have to you add clarity to the business. You need to say, remove all those assumptions that the business owners have had. Some might have been there 6 months, some might have been there 20 years. If you put a group of people into a room and you ask them to explain how they'd respond to something, you'd probably find you'd get 20 plus different answers. So if you can get everybody on the same hymn sheet, so to speak, that's probably the first step. I also think if you give people a confidence in knowledge, I'd worked briefly with some clinicians at an emergency department, one of the largest in Europe, one of the most major receiving emergency departments in Europe, and they'd seen and done everything, and there was, although they're always on their toes, there was a comfort blanket already there. So when we were trying to get them into decontamination exercises, it's something that they weren't comfortable with doing. And that's really what we had. I had to remove the assumptions that they thought that they knew what they were going to do. I had to instill the confidence that they knew where the kit was, that they could put it on, what they could physically do in it, how long it could last, all these sorts of things. I think once you give individuals, irrespective of what level they're at, if you give the individuals the confidence of the first sort of 10 to 15 key things they're going to do during an incident straight away, it gives them that extra sort of half a second of more presence of mind to make better decisions. And 9 times out of 10, they do better. But what I'm trying to say is, if you do that and you do it well and you get them to a sufficient level of maturity, what you'll see as a business will sort of take responsibility for themselves. You change the mindset of the culture. But in my experience, what tends to happen is, because the nature of the corporate cycle, once you get through one cycle of delivering any sort of approach, someone else comes in with a different approach and it changes, and the previous maturity sort of takes a step back. So it sometimes can be a case of like a staggered improvement.
One step forward, yes, and two steps back sometimes.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And that's not just from a BC professional point of view. That can be the executive sponsors, which, I mean, in today's day and age, we're talking every 2 years, 2.5 years, an executive will move on. So the initial drive and sponsorship at that level is gone. So then you have to figure out how to have a program to get the next person up to speed and bought in, and they might not even have it on their agenda depending on their background.
Sure.
So really it's difficult.
So in one of our previous email dialogues, I suggested to you it's called business continuity, and that you know, in your case, that going out into a business area, do you see, is that part of what you're talking about, that business continuity people need to get out and immerse themselves in the business, not as practitioners, but as business people not doing?
Oh, that's a very, very interesting question. I think that being a business continuity professional, you're always limited and challenged by the fact that you've never really been involved in a particular area of business. People will pontificate till the cows come home about how they don't have to be an expert in something, and that's true. But you do find some people that do come into the industry that have perhaps spent a previous sort of several years working in a particular sort of output-based environment or something that's completely focused on delivery, and then they come into BC, they tend to provide a different perspective. So perhaps it could be argued that us BC professionals could benefit from taking some time out in the industry that they work in. It certainly is the case when you look at job vacancies now. Most business continuity vacancies in the UK, at least, unless you've been working in that particular sector, they don't tend to give you much airtime. They tend to look straight for the people that have had previously worked. For instance, at the moment, there was a role available a few months ago, and it was for a health-based emergency planning and business continuity officer, but you couldn't apply for it unless you were a registered midwife. Even so, you could have 20 years experience, but if you hadn't gone and done that particular role, they weren't interested. So they wanted you to have context first. So these things are certainly changing. Similar, I think it's Heathrow Airport. They have a social worker and a business continuity professional, so an ex-social worker doing a dual role there, from my understanding. It's an airport anyhow, and they have to have that experience and background, so it must be beneficial, because otherwise the businesses wouldn't be asking for it.
Absolutely, and again, it's just this whole question of skills we need to bring to bear. Moving on, you had this wonderful idea. You suggested the idea of speed dating as a useful form of session for the BCI World Conference when you reviewed it last year. That's a great idea. I've never been to a conference that had speed dating, and I think it would, you know, be a wonderful innovation. But why was that idea important to you at the time?
I'd just like to be clear, when I say speed dating, I obviously mean in a professional setting. Although, you know, if romance blossoms where it blossoms, I can't deny that.
And we should point out to those listening, you're about to get married.
Yeah, that's it. Okay. Although I still have 5 weeks, still available for reconsideration.
That'd have to be very speed dating then.
Definitely. No, I think the speed dating was... what I found at the conference was I was meeting people that the people I already know vouched for, if you will. There was every time I met somebody, it was always a close confidant or colleague of someone that I'd worked with or I was working with, and I felt that limited me. I felt that people come at things and have different relationships with different people. So I thought what would be better is if there was people that were willing, and there certainly is, there's an abundance of people that are, in terms of recipients like myself and people wanting to be mentored and to gain greater exposure and gain contacts like yourself, Ken, that sort of opportunity would be great. So you could set like a speed dating session up, and I felt that it would be a really useful opportunity to, widen the sort of web of networks in the industry in a simple session, and I think on both sides, as you say, that they are the hard knocks and the junior pros. I think that would be welcomed, and it's fun as well. And you can do it in any sort, whether it's in the exhibition or on the evening. People tend to stay in their smaller groups. It's only the well-known characters of the industry work the room and meet different people. Even on the evening, it was still quite insular in some of the groups. And that's something we should break down, those barriers. I think it'd be very...
So I really like the idea of speed networking, Luke. And if you're going to be at the conference in London in November, I'm certainly going to be there. We should do something about maybe trying to find, even if it's an informal session, to do something about that.
I think that would be an absolutely fab idea. As far as I'm aware, I'm being invited down as a panelist onto the conference itself. So I'd be looking to utilise my time while I was down there to do something like this. And you know, you can never have too many friends in the industry, that sort of thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. So... Look, let's start to wrap this up a bit. Your Blue Eyed BC blog, mm-hmm. one post in 2015, all for a good cause of the Flash blog. But what's the future of that? Is there another generation of professionals that you want to get in there?
Yeah, I think there's the reason why I did write a blog prior to that to explain that, much like everybody else, there's a change in people's change in circumstances in personal life and professional life. So I and also as we alluded to earlier, I'm getting married and I've just purchased my house. So it's in this period of time, there's an area where I'm in a particular state of transition, where my learning itself is sort of paused for the time being, but also more important than that, I think if you apply the similar sort of, when you thought leadership, it applies to a kind of like a musician. There's a comedian in the UK who produced a comedy album and then produced a second one and called it That Difficult Second Album. And that's one of my pals told me that after he sent me a text as I won my global award. And sent me that on the moment I received my award, saying like, what's next? I think there's that I need to go through a next period of learning. The next opportunity is a very, very major role for me, and I need to take some key learning from that and try and apply some of the learning that I've perhaps given to other people as well. Because I was firefighting as I went and writing. It was a real whirlwind of learning. I do go to a couple of different universities in the UK, and I present to them, to their undergraduates, and to give them a feel. But for me, that's more a case of to remove the fear factor, demonstrating to them that somebody like me, as a chatterbox, a blue collar guy, can have quite a successful career in this area. And if you work hard at it and you're willing to contribute and learn, and that I get a lot of feedback from those university students, and they tell me how it does help. And going back to the book as well, that people are buying it, which tells me something.
Yeah, great, good for you. You've got to pay for that trip to Australia somehow.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, who are the emerging voices that I should be listening to for the next generation of practice?
One particular individual that really stands out for me is somebody that was, I assume, narrowly missed out on the opportunity of getting a recent newcomer award at the BCI European Awards. Her name's Rina.
Yeah, I read Rina's stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and the reason I think she's particularly valuable is because she provides it from a not-for-profit sector. So, but she also has a very interesting take on fresh approaches to it, because she has to be innovative, because there's no budget, there's very little resource at all there, and she has a wider remit. So I've always found the things that she writes about to be quite fresh, and I'm always interested to look at it. And as I said, the other gentleman is basically a chap that forms the Continuity Advisor website. Very, very useful overview and support in how business continuity is delivered. I think that's usually quite a useful place to go as well. They're trying to do some thought leadership, but they're a growing area as well. There are one or two. I've got quite a few on my. You'll see the people that I regularly retweet on my Twitter page that I do enjoy just taking a look at. But I suspect in the next few years we're going to see that dramatically change. We're going to see more and more people come out of the woodwork.
I sincerely hope so. I mean, it's one of those things that this is a tremendous era. Anyone can publish. I mean, as you said, here we are, because we've got a computer and a couple of microphones, we can have a discussion across the other side of the world and publish it as a podcast for people to listen and interact with. You're right, it's a tremendous opportunity for trying to open people's thinking. And Luke, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today and to share fairly openly with the audience on what you've been through and where you see things going.
Yeah, it's I think if anybody reads my work, they'll know that one of my key one of the key things about me is my honesty and frankness, and it obviously, as you can imagine, it splits the group down the middle. But no, it's what I'm about.
Excellent. Well, Luke, I sincerely hope we get after 12 months of exchanging emails, our first conversation. I sincerely hope we get to meet up in London, and I'll even buy you a beer.
Look forward to it. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks for your time, Luke.
Cheers, Ken.
Thank you for tuning in to the show today. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to encourage the podcast to continue, please head over to iTunes and leave a rating, review or comment. I would really appreciate that, and it will help us to understand what you'd like to see and hear more about in this show in future episodes. You can also jump over to our LinkedIn group if you'd like to discuss what was covered in the show today, and maybe we can get interactions with Luke himself there. I'll be back next week with another industry character who's going to share their story and perspectives on this industry and where it's going. Until then, take care.